Tonight on Arena, Palestinian cellist Nassi Malatrash plays live in studio, and Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice and Firebrand are among the movies up for review. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena, and you can follow us on, or you can watch the screening of the programme on rte.ie/arena. We're going to start with film reviews, as we so often do on Thursday evening. First up, we have Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, sequel to the 1980s horror comedy classic, reunites director Tim Burton and actor Michael Keaton, as well as several others from the original cast. We also have Firebrand, the story of how Henry VIII's sixth wife, Catherine Parr, survived against the odds. Alicia Vikander plays Parr. Jude Law as the aging king, who is accompanied by a rather unattractive festering leg ulcer throughout this film. Next up, Don't Forget to Remember, documentary from director Ross Killeen. We were speaking with Ross on the programme on Monday evening. It tells the story of Helena and her family living with her Alzheimer's diagnosis. And finally, Starvaker, which is one that one of our brave reviewers went to see, I should say, set in Yorkshire, full-on folk horror starring Matt Smith. And you have to wait and find out who it was that went to see it for a while. See, you got to give the trailer, you know. With me in studio are Donald Clark and Cara O'Doherty. Where else would we be starting except with Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice? A death in the family brings three generations back to Winter River. Only a matter of time before someone summons Michael Keaton's title ghoul to join the reunion. Just remind us, Donald, of Beetlejuice back in 1988 and why it was such a, I mean, it was a phenomenal hit at the time.
It was a phenomenal hit, and it's interesting that the tracking around this is tracking, one of those technical words, is apparently very positive. Apparently there are thousands of people out there who want to catch up with the sequel. It was also the film that pushed Tim Burton to a different level. It was his second film that and was the first one that was genuine kind of a studio smash and identified the Burton aesthetic that has been ticking along at various states of health until today. It exists because we now live in a world where nothing is allowed to die, much like Beetlejuice. And so it falls into that ugly category of the legacy sequel. Not what a legacy sequel is, really, apart from just being a sequel to something that first happened an awfully long time ago. I think it mainly means something that hasn't had a sequel for 10 or 20 years. And so here it comes lumbering along, doing the same thing that it was doing 30, nearly 40 years ago, playing with this notion of a nostalgia for horror that amongst young people, for a horror that even their grandparents were too young to properly grasp, universal horror, all that sort of thing, it played back at it. Now, that's fine. I mean, I can see there's a market for this, and I have nothing against playing to the legacy sequel market. People who are nostalgic for the past, or in this case, to a large extent, people who discovered the film long after.
Because people who want to remember why they felt.
But this is just total chaos. I mean, it's one of those films I feel that the cast wants you to know that they had a good time making it. And certainly, all the interviews I've seen beforehand, and so we had a wonderful time. It was such fun, and we're all lumbering around, and they are having fun. Willem Dafoe is up there playing the ghost of a B-movie actor who believes himself to be a noir character. It's, you know, he's
sometimes
himself.
When
Winona Ryder has now become the host of a tacky ghost show on television. She's having a great time. I wasn't having a great time at all. Right. I just found the whole thing completely chaotic.
This is often the case when actors on screen or actors on stage are having a ball.
Yeah.
The audience may not be having any type of a ball at all. Donald mentioned there to us, Cara, that Burton and Winona Ryder are back. Who else is back and who is new in Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice?
So returning is the fabulous, fabulous Catherine O'Hara, who has, since the days of Beetlejuice, gone on to be the fabulous Maura from Schitt's Creek, who's just one of the funniest actors out there. So she is back. Lydia's, Winona Ryder's character's mother-in-law. Sorry, no, stepmother. Back in the day, she was one of the most self-absorbed people you could ever meet. And somehow over the past 30 years, this woman has become far more exaggerated. She's very funny in that she's so over the top that she can't even break the news that that there's been a death in the family without it turning into a sort of a circus.
Yeah.
But there's a new character, and that's Jenna Ortega, who is playing Astrid, Lydia's daughter. And Jenna Ortega is such a star. She's plays Wednesday. She has a very Winona Ryder like quality. She is like a new her. So she doesn't really have a huge amount to do in this, but she steps into that role as her daughter very well.
Yeah.
And there's also an absolute cheese ball, sleaze bag, everything you could think of. Justin Theroux plays Lydia's horrendous TV producer slash boyfriend.
Be swift to point out that all of those adjectives are about Rory.
Yes, Rory, not Justin. It's just Rory, who really is a piece of work.
Okay, well, let's listen to a clip which features Winona Ryder as Lydia, the aforementioned Justin Theroux as Rory, and Michael Keaton as Beetlejuice, who, guess what, is going to reappear.
So you're saying that someone called Beetlejuice...
Don't say his name. If you say his name three times, he will appear.
I know this is a big step for you. But in the words of Dr. Glickman, I'm going to give you the push you need. Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. Is it?
Beetlejuice!
First of all, I want you two kids to know this is a safe space, okay? Feel free to express yourself. Don't be afraid. I sense there's an enabler here, but we'll get to that.
You're a figment of my imagination.
Really? Is this a figment of your imagination?
There you go. Michael Keaton there, Winona Ryder and Justin Theroux in a scene from Beetlejuice, Beetlejuice. I suppose, to what extent are we just... has this kind of decline that you've mentioned of Tim Burton's, has this eased the decline? Has it made the decline swifter? Or has it turned a curve upwards?
Well, I don't know. When the last genuinely good Tim Burton... Well, actually, Frankenweenie was probably the last genuinely good one. But even that's 2012. That's kind of a decade ago. I mean, to give him some credit, if credit is the word in this context, he's clearly not trying to make any kind of... develop a new masterpiece here. This is very much kind of treading water. It's a filler. It looks to have been written with a clipboard. They've basically gone through, we need these 10 things. They've gone through and ticked them all off, brought them on set, had people act out the various characters that are required in the clipboard, and they've all gone home. So I don't think he's trying that hard. Now, that doesn't sound like a compliment, yeah. But I mean, I wouldn't say that if we're going to judge the progress of Tim Burton from now until he goes to Shady Pines retirement home, this is probably not one of the films to look at. For that reason, there are a few things I like. The one thing I did fall for was the grand staging of MacArthur Park, Richard Harris's classic hit from the late 60s, early 70s, which, I mean, you would say, if you want some demonstration of the fact that they're struggling to fill space, they do the whole thing. And it was one of the longest singles ever released at that time. That I quite liked, though. I don't know if I'm just saying that because I like MacArthur Park or because I think they did anything particularly imaginative with the staging.
All right. Wednesday, it was, of course, the Jenna Ortega vehicle of a while back. Was that basically her audition for the Beetlejuice?
Pretty much, could it?
I mean, it's clearly from the same stable, and she is good in it. But her story, she gets to meet a boy. There's something funny about the boy, or is there? We're not quite sure. But her storyline, it doesn't really get played out. There's just a lot going on in this. So I mean, Beetlejuice even has his ex wife is played by Monica Bellucci.
Monica Bellucci
as a demon, and he's being chased by her. I mean, there's a lot going on. If they had just stripped it back and maybe focused either on...
I think
on...
Monica Bellucci's presence is enough for me.
I mean...
She sort of strolls on and she has such enormous presence.
When did Tim Burton ever pair anything back?
That's very true. That is true. Then maybe make it longer or maybe that... No, might that not...
Well, he's capable of doing it. I mean, a film like Ed Wood is actually quite a restrained art film. Yeah. I mean, he can do it, or he could do it at one point. But, I mean, he's not trying at this stage.
All right. I sense double disappointment here. It starts from you, first of all, Cara?
See, I'm in that weird, I think the nostalgia did get to me and I liked it better than it actually deserved because I did find it quite entertaining, although it's not great. It just about gets a 3 stars.
Yeah.
Just about. So maybe more realistically a 2.
Maybe
and
you're
half,
reliving.
Maybe.
You're possibly reliving.
It made me laugh and I didn't expect that. So I think maybe my age.
All right, stars from you, Donald?
2. I did not care for it.
Straightforward enough. Okay, let us move on to film number 2 this evening. Firebrand, British historical film based on the 2013 novel Queen's Gambit by Elizabeth Freemantle. Film stars Alicia Vikander, who spoke to us on the show earlier this week as well. She plays Catherine Parr, Queen of England, and the wife of Henry VIII, played here by Jude Law. Do we need another Tudor's history lesson on screen?
Well, you think I want to say to people, look, you know, there are other bits of English history. If you're going to do the kings and queens, great kings and queens of England, like, you know, have a crack at Henry II again, why don't you? Mm. Have a crack at the Plantagenets. But Tudors are box office. They have been for a long time. I mean, I saw this at Cannes last year, so, you know, a year and whatever, 3 months ago, and it's sort of been pottering around trying to find a space or trying to find distribution or whatever, and it took the award, to get one every year in competition, the What the Hell Is This Doing Here award, not because it's terrible, it's not terrible, but just because I don't see how this has ended up in the Cannes competition. Something in this case is totally unremarkable Sunday evening television from 1978. Right.
But you have to say that the Catherine Parr character, I mean, she did survive, which is kind of quite the feat if you're a wife of Henry VIII. And she is a very interesting character.
She is. She's absolutely fascinating. I mean, not only did she survive Henry, she survived 2 husbands before Henry and still managed to marry the most powerful man in the world. Mm. So she was incredibly smart, incredibly shrewd, and she knew how to survive.
And marriage was a political and commercial
it was
deal
absolutely.
At the time.
And like, she knew she was marrying as the 6th wife. She knew what happened to the other wives. She literally spent...
And she took on board all the children.
All
the
children.
Wives.
And she spent every day knowing the scaffold was around the corner. And she was very clever whether she embraced those children to be a mother or whether she realised she needed them in her favour for her own future, whatever her reasons. She created a family out of Henry's menagerie of children, including 2 future monarchs. She was a remarkable woman. So I do think there is a place for Tudor stories still to be told. I'm a huge fan of the Tudors, and so often we see it from Henry's side. So
yeah,
I do enjoy
it was interesting that,
to see it from her point of view.
But what we see from her, I just wonder about what it is we get to see from her point of view on the screen. One of the most interesting relationships in the film for me was between Vikander as Catherine Parr and Erin Doherty as Anne Askew, who was phenomenal. Another phenomenal character and phenomenal female character of the time.
I think that there's a certain degree of anachronism about it, which often happens with contemporary retellings of films set in this era and elsewhere in the history of the English kings and queens. You got a bit of it in Mary Queen of Scots a few years back, that they try to impose a feminist narrative on it, which is obviously not just fine, it is good to do that, but they try and turn the character herself into a more contemporary feminist than is quite plausible. I think there's a little bit of that going on with the with Catherine here. But I agree that I knew almost nothing about Anne Askew, this Protestant rabble-rouser.
And preaching Protestant dogma at the time was...
Well, I mean they set you on fire if they caught up with you. She's there to widen our gap with the religious wars, but also to give some leeway to, as I say, the film's feminist ambitions. But I think it's the sad thing about it is that all these ideas are put out there, and they have genuine ambitions to make something that makes a feminist argument. And yet, the most watchable thing in all this is Henry VIII again, and Jude Law is back. I mean,
it's been the character that has been the kind of stalwart of the big star.
Oh, sure. I mean, there's like Churchill acting, which a lot of character actors get round to at some point. There's Thatcher acting now, actually. There's over the last sort of 20 years or so, it's become a thing that female actors come round to every now and then. But yeah, I mean, Charles Laughton, Robert Shaw, Richard Burton, Charlton Heston, Damian Lewis, they've all got a pillow and stuck it up their doublet and grabbed a haunch of venison and done some cackling. And I think that this is a pretty good addition to my big book of Henry VIII acting.
Unrecognisable.
I didn't mention Sid James, of course, and Carry On Dick, who's... made the role his own in many ways. But I think Luke Law is very good. He manages that thing of being repulsive, and as you mentioned, Sean, in the introduction, that the wound on his leg, the suppurating ulcer, clearly takes on a rather clumsy metaphorical quality to it. Clearly, it goes to the corruption within the man as well.
Yeah.
The metaphorical corruption as well as the physical corruption. But nonetheless, I think he does that thing of carrying a sense of aggression and toxic masculinity around the world, at the same time conveying the degree of charisma and aggressive charm.
Yeah, he's very watchable.
He once had some years before.
What about Vikander as Catherine Parr, Cara?
See, this is the thing that really annoys me. She's normally a very strong actor, but in this, she's quite bland.
Yeah,
I mean, is that what she's given, or is that what she's
doing?
That's
the thing I can't figure out. I mean, is this a director's choice? She had to hold a lot of what she thought inside, because if you said it out loud, she would literally have lost her head. So I don't know whether they decided, right, be the kind of watchful person in the corner, but that just doesn't quite work on screen.
Well, you need a bit of action, even when you're watching, don't you?
Or even if she walks away and hides in a corner and has a meltdown, something that just brought some life. And it just annoyed me that this feminist tale ends up becoming the Henry story once again, because it's just they're just mismatched.
Yeah. It's almost a shame that Castable, who was so good as Henry VIII, because something a little less competent, a little less charismatic, maybe should have more room to breathe.
Absolutely. Or it just isn't balanced. And because really, those scenes where Vikander is on screen with Erin Doherty as Anne Askew, that's when she's at her best.
Yeah. There was a kind of lesbian relationship there, which I thought was that necessary?
But there's quite a few things in this that didn't happen in real life. I mean, there's a few elements of this story, which we won't talk about because they're spoilers, but they didn't happen. So I have problems with revisionism. If it's a very good film, I don't mind history being altered a little, but I'm quite a purist with these things. So it's a great story.
The two women
itself
were interesting enough in their own right, to let their ideas carry them rather than anything else. Overall, and stars from you on this one, Donald?
Oh, very ho-hum. I'm being a grumpy old sob today, but it's 2 stars from me as well. It's Sunday night television in 1978.
Sunday night television in 1978. Sunday night television. That's well, a bit like Beetlejuice. You've damned it twice there.
Yeah, you wouldn't see a naked wormy leg in 1978.
That's true.
But I'm going to go with 3 stars. It looks amazing, costume wise, set wise, and for those good moments. But it's there's no fire for a firebrand.
Oh, no fire for firebrand. Not going on the poster, that one. It's hasten to add. Okay, let us move on to film number 3. We spoke to Ross Killeen, director, on the programme earlier in the week. This is a documentary about living with Alzheimer's, inspired in part by Killeen's own experience of dealing with his mother's dementia. But this, Cara, is told through the story of a woman called Helena, who is the mother of a street artist called Asbestos.
Yeah, Asbestos is very well known to many people, particularly in Dublin. His artwork is across the city. And his mother, unfortunately, has Alzheimer's. And they take this approach. He is creating an art project based on what she is going through. So it's this mixed hybrid documentary that sees his art, how it changes because of how he is experiencing this.
Yeah.
But it's also this very lovely observational documentary that has beautiful scenes of the family together talking about the past, showing her photographs, and seeing how art and memory can help to bring back fleeting bits. But it's very lovely, and it's hard to get that mix between art house documentary and sort of straight narrative doc, and it's a really good hybrid of the two.
And one of the art house and the kind of the artistic expression of the pain that the family are experiencing is one thing. But the husband and wife relationship here, it tears to an absolute stone. I better get the clip playing before I start, because this is the husband is Matt and Helena. And as he so often does, he's doing the crossword with her, and kind of you can see that it's an exercise in trying to jog her verbal memory. And you'll hear the voice of Asbestos coming in towards the end of the clip then.
A woman in relation to her child. What would you call the woman that was related to a child? Starts with a name.
What's been happening to my mum is shocking and scary. I'm both experiencing it, but also almost observing it as well, and it kind of feels distant at times.
Losing your memory is like watching a bullet in slow-mo for years coming towards you and you can't avoid it. So much is actually about recounting memory and about shared memories. And only with your memories are you able to kind of construct who you are.
That's the voice of Asbestos there at the end of that clip from Don't Forget to Remember, the film which also featured in that clip, Matt and Helena, husband and wife and father and mother of Asbestos. Donald, Ross Killeen had given us the Damien Dempsey documentary, Love Yourself. He sets the bar high for himself, and he really sets the bar high in what he's doing with this documentary.
He does. I mean, it's interesting. I watched this first in the Dublin International Film Festival, and I misunderstood what I was watching, first of all, because as you pointed out, one of his own parents, one of Ross's own parents, had the same experience. And I thought I was watching the director's parents, because I kind of deliberately didn't look at the notes. It's often great to sit down when you are watching a film at a festival and not know anything about it. And it gradually began to emerge that I was, in fact, watching Asbestos's parents go through this. And I think you're quite right to point out the fact that it is a very interesting blend. I mean, it honours both the two strands that run through it. And one strand is quite a traditional observational documentary that the camera is there with the couple as the husband in particular, the father in particular, plays these games which you feel are going to take him nowhere. I mean, it seems to be filling in space where this terrible story unfolds that we all know that it's only going in one direction. And that is, I think, moving because you know that it can only go in one direction, and in a sense he is only just kind of, you know, filling in the time and feels that something must be done, and this is something, so he will do this. And the same, on the parallel strand, you have the strand of the documentary that is gathers itself around Asbestos and his work. And those two things are impressively coordinated. It does not feel like there's not a juddering halt when you go from one to the other. And that works its way, that works itself into the archival footage they have as well. It's interesting that I thought this was the Mary Robinson documentary as well, how moving home cinema is
Can
in a
be.
Way that I don't think that the camera film footage ever will be. The medium itself communicates something of the past.
Yeah, it tells us, it dates the thing in some ways. But one of the aspects of Asbestos's work is the fact that he makes these chalk drawings on blackboards, which he then hangs up outside for the rain and the wind to get rid of. And not only that, he also puts a duster and some chalk beside it, inviting people to come along and rub this out and put out whatever you want in there instead. And there's a wonderful parallel between that and Alzheimer's,
it's
of course.
It's incredibly moving, because just to like her, these paintings are changing. They're bit by bit, they're being forgotten. They're becoming something else. And it was so, so very moving and the way they're placed and how they're filmed as they change over time. There's also just a moment that floored me at the exhibition itself when something changes with one of the paint. I won't say what it is, but there's something changes about one of the paintings and I was gone.
And also just his showing his parents those paintings is an incredibly moving moment. It really does a great job at telling this story and telling both sides of it overall. And stars from you, Donald?
Oh, four. I thought it was excellent.
And what are you saying, Cara?
Without doubt, four. Very moving. And I love the fact that for all its sadness, it's not completely full of despair. There's some lovely moments of just hope and family and lightness in there as well. Beautiful.
Yeah, I loved the fact that his mother laughs every time she sees a picture of Asbestos as a young boy. It was just lovely. Okay, so very solid, scoring from both of you there. And finally, the moment comes when I reveal that having been to see...
Can we have a drum roll?
It's just desperate for cliffhangers.
I just like to create one, you know. Donald Clark has boldly gone to see Yorkshire Horror star Acre, starring Matt Smith and based on a novel by Andrew Hurley. Good time, good year for horror films. What's the setup here?
We do seem to have gotten to a good place with horror films recently. I mean, after going through a few bad years with there was the start of the century, there were all those terrible rip-offs of J horror films, Japanese horror films. Then you had torture porn and so forth. Now you've got a variety. Now, this great film by Daniel Cocatayo, I think I'm going to get his name right, possibly doesn't, who directed a brilliant film called Apostasy a few years back, which was based around his experiences in the Jehovah Witnesses and leaving Jehovah Witnesses. And he's now made an adaptation of Andrew Michael Hurley's book of the same name, which we cannot stop ourselves calling folk horror. One of those words, one of those phrases that we didn't know what folk horror was when we were watching Witchfinder General or The Wicker Man back in the 1970s and 80s. But now we do know what it is. It's this. It's horror.
It's films like Wicker Man.
Exactly. It's horror. It takes place in the countryside where people get covered in mud before the devil arrives. It's a terrific film, a really terrific film. Morford Clark and Matt Smith are this couple in the wilds of Yorkshire. Their son dies and they get sucked into the old religion whenever that happens. On your first viewing, what really captivates, I think, is that fusty 1970s feeling. It's set in the 70s, but it's not just set then. It feels as if it was made then. It's something about...
But in a good way.
Oh, yeah. It's something of a... Sorry, I'm repeating myself here, obviously. I haven't made that analogy with Firebrand, but in a conscious and good way here. You feel like you're watching one of those plays for today that you weren't old enough to watch. It has that kind of creepy, eerie feeling about it. And it also has some great practical effects. Towards the middle of the film, this reanimated hair emerges from nowhere and becomes a kind of malign presence lurking about the house. And that's all done with practical effects in a way that's really convincing and feels solid and earthy and muddy and settling. And I thought that was just terrific.
You enjoyed yourself in a horror type of way. Stars?
4.
A solid 4 from Donald Clark for Star of Acre. Star of Acre and Don't Forget to Remember are both at select cinemas, while Beetlejuice, and Firebrand are both on general release. My thanks to both Donald Clark and Cara O'Doherty. Nassim Al-Attrash is a Grammy-nominated Palestinian cellist and composer known for blending traditional Arabic music with jazz and contemporary influences. He has performed at prestigious venues like the Kennedy Center, the Lincoln Center, and major jazz festivals worldwide. Alongside his solo career, Al-Attrash performs with renowned ensembles, teaches at Berklee, Tufts, and Longy Schools of Music in America. His Irish debut will be this weekend at a gala concert called Croíonna Féile. You're welcome here, kind stranger in Drogheda. And that is all part of the Sean Corcoran series. Delighted that Nassim is with me in studio this evening. I'm kind of wondering, you grew up in Bethlehem, Nassim. How much cello music was there around you when you were there?
Actually, growing up, I never heard about cello or heard a cello until I was 12 years old. And when I wanted to learn music, I saw a violin first on TV, and I was like, I want to play that. I love that instrument. And at the time, there was no violin teacher available in Bethlehem, and I was recommended to play the cello by my brother, who had just came back from a trip and met an Egyptian cellist. And he said, there's an instrument called a cello. You should check it out. It's just bigger. It's the same, it's just bigger. So I went back to the conservatory the next day, and I said, you told me violin was not available. So what about the cello? And they were really shocked, because at the time there was none, like no Palestinian cello students, maybe one in other city. But they said, cello, that's a big instrument. Why? How did you, it's random, like why did you choose a cello? So it was really late until I discovered it. But every time I heard the cello, from my first lesson, I would get goosebumps right away. It spoke to me.
Yeah, so
very powerful.
You wanted to play the violin when you saw it. You wanted to play the cello when you heard it, I guess.
It changed my mind.
Yeah, it changed your mind. So you weren't hearing the sound of the cello all around you in Bethlehem. What were you hearing?
I grew up listening to Arabic music, music from Palestine, from Lebanon, from Egypt, from Syria. That's the music that my father would play for us in the house. Music by composers like Muhammad Abdul Wahab from Egypt, Farid Al-Atrash, who has the same last name like me, but we're not related, was a great composer. Singers like Umm Kulthum, who's a legendary singer from Egypt. I also grew up listening to Greek music because my dad studied in Greece and he had a big collection of Greek music. So that was another genre that I grew up listening to, the Greek bouzouki and singers from Greece. And of course, the music of the church. I grew up in a Christian family in Bethlehem. So the Byzantine music of the Orthodox Church, which is also very similar to the music of the Middle East. It has those same maqamat, which is the tonal system that we use in Palestine. And we will talk about it a little more today.
And then, so that was the musical background to what you were hearing in Bethlehem at the time. But you're going to play us a piece which, in fact, is inspired not just by the music that you heard growing up, but the sounds of the city. Am I right in calling it a city of Bethlehem?
Yes. This piece is called Riwaya, and it's part of a suite that I composed for cello and orchestra. And this piece, for me, the first movement of the suite is about my experience growing up in Bethlehem. I'm actually from a small town called Beit Sahur, which is known as the town of the shepherd's fields. The tourists come especially to visit the shepherd's fields that are mentioned in the story of the birth of Jesus. And that city is just a mile away from Bethlehem. And for me, this piece is a reflection of the sounds I heard growing up, the smells of the city, the freshly baked pita bread in the morning, the old markets, walking around, seeing people selling all kinds of things, the sound of the church bells harmonizing with the mosque, the call to prayer, all of these sounds together. For me, this piece is a reflection of those sounds.
Nice of a listen.
I will improvise a little bit and go into the piece.
Mm-hmm. Riwaya. Is that how I say that?
Riwaya.
Riwaya is exactly the title of the piece. What is that? Does that word have a specific meaning?
Riwaya means like a tale or a story.
Ah, yeah. Yes. And that is what I felt you telling me a story. Nassim Al-Attrash, the Palestinian cellist playing for us live on Arena this evening. What struck me, you mentioned going into that piece about how the sounds of the mosque, the call to prayer, and the sounds of the bells of the Christian churches played in harmony with each other. I couldn't help but notice the sadness that is very prevalent in the opening section in particular of that piece. To what extent is that an expression of your feelings about the current situation in your homeland?
Absolutely. I believe as a musician, you can't be removed from reality. What we play, the music we compose, and the music that you improvise is coming out of the feelings that you're feeling in the moment and the time in history that you're in and the personal life. And I believe I could speak for every Palestinian right now with the genocide that's going on in Gaza, that we have not felt normal for the past 9 months, 10 months. I believe any music that I would be playing right now is going to be influenced by those heavy feelings that I'm having.
In fact, I think I was talking to you before we came to where you have family still in Bethlehem.
Yes, I have my parents are currently in Bethlehem, and as well as my uncles, aunts, and my extended family. They all live. We're a big family.
Mm. And that can't be easy. You being here and things like they are at the moment in Bethlehem and in the West Bank in particular.
Absolutely. Whether it's in the West Bank or whether it's in Gaza, I have also friends and musicians in Gaza who I've been trying to help get out as well. And students, cello students that were always in touch with me, who live in Gaza and are still going through it every day. And you have my parents and my family now in Palestine as well, in the West Bank. We're praying and we're hoping that there will be an end soon, and we're doing all we can to also tell the world and gain as much support from countries around the world. And Ireland has always been one of the countries that showed the most support to Palestine, and I'm really grateful.
And indeed, Dr. Gian Walba, who is the Palestinian ambassador here in Ireland, will be at the concert that you're taking part in. That must be will make it very special for you, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed. I'm honored that she's coming and she's taking time to come to the concert and attend. And I'm just really proud that she will be there, and I'm looking forward to meeting her in person.
Again, to go back to the piece that we just heard, and the opening section in particular did it for me. I felt in some ways, if there were a voice singing that, it wouldn't be 1,000 miles off a Shannos Irish song. You know, do you know if the mode you talked about, what was the title or the word you used for the Arabic modal?
It's called maqam.
Maqam. Do you know if there are echoes or similarities between maqam and the kind of modal, the scales that might be used in Shannos singing? And particularly in the ornaments. I mean, there were things you were doing on the cello that sounded like a Shannos ornament.
Yes, I would say maybe the aesthetic is similar in the sense that it's modal and it's we use a good deal of ornamentation. And when you're playing an instrument in the Arabic tradition, the goal is to try to sing on your instrument. That's what you're trying to achieve. When I learned to play Arabic cello, which is not very common, I was a student at the conservatory, Edward Said Conservatory, studying classical cello, and I did study classical cello, classical Western cello for a long time. But I was always hanging out with the with the Arabic, classical Arabic music players. I learned playing the cello like that by imitating singers and trying to hear what they're doing with their voice and see how can I do that on the cello.
Well, one of the things that I noticed was that the prevalence of glissando, you know, the slide on the note, which is very much an ornament within Irish Shannos singing. And there's another thing I saw you doing online today. I was looking at somewhere I always thought there's B, the note B, there's the note B flat, and then there's the note A if you were going down on the piano. But no, not in Arabic music. There are a lot of notes between B and B. There's a B half flat. Maybe you'd give us an example of that and how the glissando helps you, gives that sense of ornamentation within it.
Yeah. So if you think about B natural, which is like the major third, you get...
Yeah.
Right? Minor third, B flat. What if we want a neutral sound? It's neither minor or major. It's in between. It's not...
Yes.
It's between. And in Arabic music, we call this the quarter tone. And we have quarter tones and we have notes that are an eighth of a tone, so we call them neutral tones or microtones. So in this case, B half flat. To us, this sounds like it's just part of our music. To a Western ear, that might be slightly foreign and unusual sound, but the way we use it, sliding into it, doing certain kinds of ornaments and vibrato, it just tonalizes the microtone, and it's a beautiful sound. It's neither minor, it's nor major. It's a different feeling.
Yeah, and I guess part of this, the event that you're involved in, the Sean Corcoran series, will be about seeing how that all fits in with the Irish music that will be around you on the night. And in fact, you were also telling me about a project you're going to be involved in subsequent to the Sean Corcoran series.
Yes. A few months ago, Rosa Corcoran, who is the director of the festival, the Sean Corcoran Festival, reached out and she invited me to perform at the festival. But she also had an idea, and I think this is an amazing idea. She had an idea that she would be the creative director or producer of a collaboration that would bring together my playing on the Arabic cello with Neil Martin, the celebrated cellist from Ireland, that plays Irish cello and composes wonderful, amazing music based from out of the Irish music. And the idea is that we would go together to the Tyrone Guthrie Center
in Monaghan, yeah.
And we would spend 3 days just talking, playing, improvising together, learning from each other, and then eventually compose a piece that is a piece for two cellos, speaking both of these languages, and orchestra.
Yeah,
and I'm really excited to see where this project goes.
Well, I'm excited to see where it goes to, and I look forward to you and Neil coming in and sitting in this studio and playing that piece for me. I'm going to have to leave it at that for the scene. But thank you so much for the piece that you played for us and for that little demonstration of the various techniques as well. That's Nassim Alatrash. Nassim will be part of Creen the Fela. You're welcome here, kind stranger, with Darren the Gracoin, who was speaking to us earlier in the week. Len Graham, Cora Venus, Lonnie, Neve, Burry, Theo, Dorgan, Libby, McCrohan, the Sunday's Gate Quartet, Michael Olohan, Owen McGill of Regia, and believe it or not, more, they tell us, at St. Augustine's Church in Drogheda. That all takes place this Saturday, and you can find out full details on SeanCorcoranSeries.com. The Leitrim-based Adaptation Festival is in its 11th year. Each year, along with a programme of films, the festival highlights a particular artist and how their work has been represented on film. This year's the artist in focus is Flann O'Brien, Brian O'Nolan, Brian O'Nolan, Miles Nicopoline, whatever you want to call him. A number of films, both documentaries and film adaptations of his work, will be shown as part of the festival running in Manor Hamilton from the 19th through until the 22nd of September. To talk about Miles and some of the films being shown at the adaptation, I'm joined by Keith Hopper, who has written on the work of Flann O'Brien and is introducing the film series at the festival, and Maurice Sweeney, filmmaker himself, who directed Flann O'Brien, The Lives of Brian, in which Keith was one of the contributors. Maurice, The Lives of Brian, worthy of whatever name you want to call him, probably worthy of Miles Nicopoline, I would have thought, The Lives of Brian. When did that title hit you across the forehead?
Fairly early, Sean. I mean, just the duality of the man and what he was thinking, the postmodernism, it was just... it kind of just jumped up immediately, and the Miles Nicopoline, as you said, was kind of key to the making of the film. Really, he kind of brings it all together in a way throughout the narrative.
And you have the narration, the narrative voice throughout the piece is that of Brendan Gleeson, who I know is a huge fan of O'Brien's and particularly of At Swim Two Birds. How involved was Brendan from the outset?
Brendan was great. I hope he doesn't mind me saying this, but he came in to do voiceover. And he had never done it before. And he was nervous as a kitten. And it took us a long day to get it right. But he was so impassionate about Flan. You know, he was developing his own script of At Swim Two Birds at the time. And I just think he just cared so much about it. He wanted to get it right. So it was just lovely to have Brendan there. And just, I think it just added a kind of, just a genuine sense of love to what Flan had done, you know.
Keith Hopper, what do you call him? Where did you, when you're talking about this man with the many names and the many identities, duality is one way of describing it. I would have thought there's a whole bundle of personalities inside him. How do you describe him? What do you call him?
Yeah, there's always the dance around his names when you start talking first. I tend to refer to him now as Brian O'Nolan. You know, to give the man behind the mask his credit, because there's not just Miles or Flann O'Brien who, you know, for the novels, there's a dozen at least pseudonyms. So I think to go back to Brian O'Nolan himself and give him the credit he's probably due. Yeah. I think is how I describe him. Yeah.
So to go back to that real name, he came at a time, I suppose, when the likes of Sean O'Fillon, this is discussed in the film, Sean O'Fillon and Frank O'Connor were giving us a particular type of realism, I suppose one could argue, or naturalism, and we were also coming out of the huge shadow cast by James Joyce across Irish literature by way of modernism. Where does Brian O'Nolan fit into that, Keith?
He doesn't fit into any of it, which is what's interesting. You know, I mean, O'Fuelan, O'Connor, all of that, he talked about far too cozy. Knitting, he referred to it at one point. He also detested, by the way, Yeats and Singh and the whole Celtic toilet, as you call it. So, you know, he rejects the realism, he rejects the romanticism. He tends towards Joyce in his experimentalism. But he also thinks that Joyce, for all his linguistic brilliance, has gone too far. I mean, he's written, you know, 1939, Finnegan's Wake comes out. How many people can and have actually read it? So he brings out his novel. The last two novels that Joyce read before he went blind were Beckett's debut novel, Murphy, and At Swim Two Birds. And he said of Flann that this was a real writer with the true comic spirit. So Joyce himself recognised that something new was beginning to emerge post-modernism.
Yeah, and At Swim Two Birds was that first success for him. But he had a peculiar attitude of, let's have a listen to Eamon Morrissey, who features quite a lot in the film. And here he is talking about an encounter he had with Brian O'Nolan and talking to him about his admiration for At Swim Two Birds.
Well, I knew him from Neary's pub in Chatham Street, because that's where sort of theatre and literary people crossroads. And I congratulated him on this wonderful, it would be all right if I congratulate him on this great print. And he ate the face off me. Anybody who likes that puerile nonsense has obviously got a very banal and silly mind, you know. He gave me an awful going over. And now maybe I begin to understand what he was at. Because, I mean, not that the book is puerile nonsense by any means. I mean, anybody would die to be able to write like that. But I think he might have felt at that stage of his life that his creative ability had stopped in a kind of an adolescence.
There you go. That's Eamon Morrissey talking about Brian O'Nolan's hatred, almost, it sounds like, of his own book, At Swim Two Birds. But you'd wonder when he was telling you the truth and when he wasn't telling you the truth, Brian O'Nolan, that is. There's a wonderfully nostalgic feel to the film, Morris Sweeney, The Lives of Brian, in that we get Tom Hickey going around on a bicycle, just beautiful footage of him doing that. Lots of Eamon Morrissey as the brother, or in the brother, and the famous pint of plain and all of that. How nostalgic a trip was it?
It was wonderful because I suppose I was relatively new to Flann. I'd read At Swim, which I always loved and still close to my heart. I suppose when we approached making the film, we kind of realised, I mean, this is 18 years ago, Sean. So, and I remember it well because my twins were born right in the middle of filming it. But it was kind of, we knew we couldn't take a kind of conventional approach to documenting his life.
Yeah.
We wanted to have a bit of fun with it, to be honest with you, you know, and a bit of anarchy. And it kind of relates to what Fintan O'Toole said about him a lot of ways, because he should be a national treasure, but he's just too radical in a lot of ways, you know, for that.
Yeah, and there's a terrible sadness in it as well when we get the story of the third policeman and how it was rejected, and then he kind of pretended, I lost the manuscript of the book. There is something terribly sad about that, and that the success didn't come until a posthumous stage. But there are other films, Keith, that you'll be introducing at the festival that give us other sides of O'Nolan, are there?
Yes, we're going to show in the beginning Morris's brilliant documentary, because it is very playful. It's almost a metafictional film, and it captures the kind of absurd atmosphere. So that's about 50 minutes. We'll show that, have a bit of a chat with the audience. And then we're going to look at a film that Johnny Gogan himself made. It's 16 minutes, A Stray, from 2011. That was the centenary of Flan's birth. And that's about a play being performed based on A Swim Two Birds in Sligo. And then Sweeney, one of the fictional characters, the medieval figure of Sweeney Astray, comes down from the trees to attend the screen, to attend the stage play. So it's again like Morris's doc, it's in the spirit of Flan, which I think is wonderful.
And just finally on the subject,
and we'll also be showing, which I think one of my favorites, John Duffy's Brother. I think Flan's best short story from 1940 was adapted by Michael Murphy, another Sligo man actually.
Yeah.
In 2006. It's only 15 minutes long, but I think it's absolutely superb, and it just shows how amenable Flan is still to being adapted. I think we've only scraped the surface of it.
Yeah, and also within Morris's film, we get the story of the Cruisín Lán, of course, the great Bertie Smiley, the Irish Times editor who brought in Miles Nagopoulin, or gave birth to Miles Nagopoulin through that. And we do get some very interesting aspects of that. However, I thought, Morris, that a pint of pain might be a good way to finish. what was O'Nolan's attitude to this piece of poetry?
Flan's attitude?
Yes.
I mean, look, he's always having fun, you know. He kind of talked to the great unwashed,
he was looking for the blandest, he was in a competition for the blandest poem he could make up, and he won first and second prize. And here's a verse of the poem that won him that.
In times of trouble and lousy strife, you still have a darling plan. You still can turn to a brighter life. A point of plain is your only man. That is a poem that will be heard, and it'll live as long as there's a hard root of an Irishman left by the Almighty on this planet. Mark my words.
There you go, Eamon Morrissey with A Pint of Plain, Keith Hopper and Morris Sweeney, director of Lives of Brian, speaking to me about the Adaptation Festival, which is on in Manor Hamilton, County Leitrim, from 19th through to the 22nd of September. Full information on adaptation.ie. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. James Feeney on sound. Tonight's programme produced by Sinead Egan. Talk to you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RT Radio 1. And, his name has gone out of me. No, it's not John Creedon down there tonight. It is Ray Cudahy who is sitting in the seat for John tonight. He'll be with you after the news.